Good morning, it's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Since Freddie Gray's death in police custody, questions about why police chased and arrested him April 12th, even before the fateful transport in a van, have focused attention on what factors are influencing police when they patrol. Protesters have shouted that police would not have chased a white man talking to a friend on North Avenue. It may be an issue in the trials of some of the police officers charged in Gray's death. Long before that Sunday morning and the uprising that unfolded after it, the U.S. Justice Department had issued guidelines to end discriminatory profiling by law enforcement. Late last month, Maryland's Attorney General followed up with guidelines for law enforcement in this state, declaring that officers should not consider race, ethnicity, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, disability, or religion in routine police activities. The main author of those Maryland guidelines, Deputy Attorney General Thiruvendra Vignaraja, is here with us to discuss them. He's a Baltimore native who was a Maryland Assistant U.S. Attorney in the Violent Crimes Division before taking on his current job. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
And also with us is Alex Long, community organizer and a youth advocate with the Rose Street Community Center in East Baltimore. Welcome.
Good morning.
Now, Thiruvendra Vignaraja, what do these guidelines tell officers that they didn't already know?
You know, when Eric Holder issued his guidelines, in many respects,
The U.S. Attorney General,
he was expanding upon guidance that the U.S. Attorney General had issued before, which were very limited in the sense that they only applied to race and ethnicity and national origin. And it also didn't make clear, with examples and illustrations, what types of things actually impact police work on the ground every day. For the first time, Maryland has issued guidance that applies to a much broader class of characteristics that are sometimes the basis of police work. It also makes it very clear that it can't just not be the sole justification. It can't be considered to any degree in routine police encounters. This is the first state, and we're proud to be the first state to issue these guidelines and apply them to state officers in Maryland.
Well, and I understand these are statewide, and there are lots of different law enforcement agencies that will be digesting these and taking them into account. But specifically in Baltimore last year, police officers began training in what's called fair and impartial policing, a program that was promoted by the Justice Department to get rid of racial bias. The Baltimore Sun reported that all of Baltimore's officers under that program are expected to complete their training by the end of 2015. And so I read your guidelines, and I thought, at one level, they seem kind of obvious.
Well, we're glad to hear that, and we are excited to see the response by police who have uniformly and really without exception embraced this. But there are essentially 16,000 sworn officers in Maryland who work for 150 different police agencies, some very large that have established training programs, some quite small that don't have either articulated policies or corresponding trainings. And so this gives an opportunity to make clear what the standard should be, not just in Baltimore City, not just for the Maryland State Police, but for smaller jurisdictions, rural jurisdictions, other urban areas. This is the first time where we make it clear that this is not permitted. And it's great to hear you say that this is obvious, but for a lot of folks, it's not. The types of law enforcement practices that have given rise to so many stories. When the Attorney General unveiled this, you heard Ike Leggett, a county executive, Angela Alsobrooks, lead state's attorney
for
major jurisdiction in Prince George's County, talk about their stories. And everybody has a story that are told and retold about how they are the victims of profiling. And making it clear and giving police an opportunity to stand up and say, this is not our policy, this is not how we want to build cases, this is not how we want to build trust in the communities, has been very important.
And this is where I want to talk to Alex. You live in East Baltimore.
Yes, ma'am.
Before the riot and the unrest in April, have you seen assumptions on the part of police that affect how they patrol?
I honestly believe that's part of their job. It's a separate system. As you spoke before, a lot of different agencies come into play here. So Baltimore City, no matter how large they may be, don't have the funding to train nor equip their officers like they should. So they almost create a hostile environment and put them out there. And anybody that go into a hostile environment already walks on eggshells because, you know, you're not comfortable and sure what can and may happen. And a lot of these officers go into neighborhoods where they really don't know anything about the people in the community. So anybody that they may see that register that, you know, they match a trait to something that I think may happen, then that's reason for me to do my job. So to me in Baltimore City, all it takes is a thought. And when you're surrounded by, you know, 90% African-Americans, it's almost impossible in a sense to racial profile simply because there's no other race to deal with. So to them, they really don't see that they're doing something wrong, because I can't say I'm racial profiling when I'm only coming across, you know, African-Americans, or I'm only coming across, you know, Caucasians. So because it's a separate system, it creates racial profiling.
You're saying because the housing is so segregated and neighborhoods are
exactly.
tend to be all one or all another.
Exactly.
You don't see any way that a guideline that says don't take race, among other things, into account has an effect?
Not immediately. It definitely could have effect because it need to be done. We need to have a universal policing system. You know, the laws and rules shouldn't change based off a county line or a city limit. And a lot of times that's what happened. You know, you go out Baltimore County, half the stuff that you get harassed for in the city, they'll never consider doing because they view you differently. They look at you as a neighbor. So I wouldn't want to upset my neighbor, you know. But like I say, where I come from, they only see us when they come to work.
That's Alex Long, an organizer with the Rose Street Community Center in East Baltimore, here on Maryland Morning Idiot One. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Thiru Vignaraja, Maryland's Deputy State Attorney General. And let me ask you what you think when you hear Alex describe, hey, it's a separate system and I expect it to be.
You know, rebuilding the relationship and the trust between police and the communities they serve is the absolute foundation of this. There was a Gallup poll this past summer that said that only about half of Americans have a great deal of faith or quite a lot of faith in police. That's something we have to fix. On September 11th, it's useful to remind everyone that these are the people that run towards danger. They risk their lives every day, and the overwhelming majority of them are doing exactly what we expect of them. But when a person has an experience that they feel implicates profiling, it erodes that trust. And trying to rebuild that trust starts with announcing these principles and then translating them into practice. And the idea that we've come far enough is I think, very is dangerous. You know, Julian Bond, the celebrated civil rights leader, had this great quote before his death that the greatest impediment to achieving racial equality is the narcotic belief that we already have. We've come a long way, but we have a long way to go.
Okay, but speaking of narcotic beliefs, I think there may be listeners who say, telling me that police officers are not going to notice I'm black or notice I'm transgender or notice my ethnicity is not realistic. I mean, can you really address that with training? I know you're putting training together.
You know, training is a starting point for directing people to think about implicit bias, which is one of the things that I think you're alluding to. We're not expecting police officers to pretend that they don't see characteristics that are relevant to criminal investigations. Just like the federal guidelines, there's two different standards. One of the standards is for investigations where a victim gives a description of a perpetrator that does include their race, their height, their clothing description. And those are relevant factors in identifying folks in the same areas they're trying to identify suspects. The real challenge is making sure that this is not part of routine police behavior. And there are some police departments that have made it clear that profiling is not okay if it's the sole justification, but that you can think about it to some degree. This changes that.
Alex, you said a minute ago, in the long term, you think there could be a change. Tell me what you think would make a difference.
The only thing that truly would make a difference to me is these officers actually going out, bonding with the community. I've seen a couple pics and stuff on like Instagram, Facebook, and things. Officers going out playing football and, you know, actually like trying to bond with the community. That's what it truly takes. Because at the end of the day, they supposed to be our heroes. Regardless if anybody like the police or not, at the end of the day, whenever we will become a victim or may become a victim, they will be the first person we call. So we need them. Nobody's denying that we need them. It's just we don't want to feel like, you know, it's a POW camp. Like, you know, we prisoners of war and it's, this is what we stuck with. And a lot of times with they system, it's not the fact that it's done. It's the fact that once it's done, it's either a cover-up or it's not that bad. Like, say, whenever racial profiling happens, can happen any and every time. Like, say, it is actually used as part of their practice. But it's the fact that once it's understood that you crossed the line, that it's adjusted and fixed. In most cases, it's just swept under the rug or, you know, sucked into the program where everybody get on board to this is the culture.
Let me ask you, Vignaraja, will having these guidelines in place address the point that Alex just made?
I really think it will. Alex is exactly right. Police should be our heroes, and for many of us, they are. And it was a real sight to behold when these guidelines were unveiled to see the ACLU and the NAACP stand shoulder to shoulder with police executives and police chiefs and prosecutors and say, this is incompatible with our promise of equal justice for all. And that is going to be translated into practice so that it's not just fine words on paper. It's reflected in the everyday experiences of citizens. And that's how we think we're going to rebuild these relationships, not just in Baltimore, not across Maryland, but across the country.
I wish we had more time because this is a really important topic. And I really appreciate you both giving us at least a beginning to think about it. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to have us come down and speak on it.
Thank you, Sheila.
Alex Long is a community organizer and a youth advocate with the Rose Street Community Center in East Baltimore. Thiru Vignaraja is Deputy Attorney General, who helped write the recent guidelines. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, movies to keep an eye out for this coming fall. Stay with us on 88.1.